That's all I want to say from my own perspective. I think that it's in poor taste for white men to use privilege politics in pissing matches with each other, to try to accuse each other of hypermasculinity or this or that. Instead, I'd like to foreground somebody else's voice here, a woman who can't be here today because she is serving a year in prison in Toronto, accused of being the so-called leader of the Black Bloc at the protests against the G20 summit in 2010. Her name is Kelly Rose Flugbeck, and she answered the same question with these words. Patriarchal society in general is infected with a deeply disturbing hypermasculinity. Patriarchy and prejudice against people with disabilities are deeply connected, and both pressure people to believe their worth depends on whether their body is attractive, useful, normal, and non-threatening according to dominant standards. Many of the things that people vandalized during the G20 were symbols of patriarchy, like window advertisements with emaciated, underage-looking girls in hypersexualized poses. Being constantly bombarded with these unhealthy images is hurtful and violating to people of all genders. Global capitalism is also inextricably linked to kinds of violence and exploitation that disproportionately affect women and girls. So in that sense, any form of opposition to the G20, multinational corporations, or trade blocs is also an opposition to patriarchy. There are many documented cases of female workers in sweatshops being systematically raped because they protested their work conditions. And the colonial history and ongoing economic exploitation of the Congo is what has caused the civil strife and pandemic of gang rapes that Congolese women are suffering right now. If Chris Hedges wants to speak out about the prevalence of hypermasculinized violence in the world, he should rail against governments and multinational corporations, not a scraggly bunch of protesters who oppose them. Now, I know that that is one of the things that Chris does, but we are here today because in practice, his rhetoric helps the state to marginalize, to invisibilize, and to imprison women like Kelly Rose Flugbeck.
Well, I can assure you the state doesn't give a damn about what I write. Somehow the idea that they're using my writings as a use to imprison people or marginalize them is absurd. I'm as locked out of the mainstream as the Black Bloc. You know, I'm hardly a figure that the establishment uses to credentialize themselves. You know, on the issue of violence, on the issue of diversity of tactics, if the Black Bloc want to carry out an action, I actually think they have every right to do it. I'm not going to join them, but I'm also not going to inform on them. My problem is that they make it impossible for those of us who want to build a nonviolent movement to carry out our action. And there has to be a place, there is a place in insurgencies and uprisings for various movements. When I covered the war in El Salvador, you had groups such as the Catholic Human Rights Group that would document the killings by the death squads and yet studiously espoused nonviolence. And yet when I traveled with the FMLN rebels, they would often give me carefully typewritten testimonies by people who lived in combat zones who had suffered at the hands of Salvadoran security forces, and they would ask me to deliver those typewritten testimonies to the Human Rights Office at the Catholic Church because they knew that congressmen and others who came down would be able to hear those testimonies. And what I'm asking for is diversity of tactics. What I'm asking for is that you respect nonviolence and you carry out actions that don't turn our nonviolent activities into your vision of what you think resistance should be.
We have one last question before moving on to the audience questions. This question is to Brian. How do these individual issues relate to our greater visions of social change, how it comes about, and what we're trying to do? How can our tactics distinguish and free us from the institutions we oppose? And how can our tactics embody the world we hope to create?
Right. Thank you very much. I want to explain why I am making an effort to critique this cancer in Occupy line. I want to emphasize why that's an issue. Chris and I are not that far apart ideologically. The one place that we differ is how we respond to the appearance of more militant tactics. Now, I'm with Chris. There's a time and place for everything. I agree with him about that. But that's not what he claimed in the Cancer and Occupy piece. He said that the Black Bloc is a totally distinct social body that has its own agenda that is against all of you, even those of you who have participated in Black Blocs. And that it has to be excised like a medical abnormality. This runs counter to my understanding of how social movements work. And it seems to me that we have a really different idea of how this works. My impression from what I've seen is that in a situation in which most people don't feel entitled to use certain tactics, whether it is to do things that are illegal or to defend themselves, or to mask their faces when they need to do that to protect themselves, in this situation, what always happens is that a few outliers try out a new tactic, and at first it's extremely controversial, but if they do it long enough and seriously enough, and they always make the effort to explain themselves to others, eventually, if this tactic is of use, it can catch on, and it can be useful to other people. A good example of this is that, you know, Occupy Wall Street was not the first occupation in this country, right? If you go back to 2009, there was an occupation in the New School that at the time was controversial, did not take off, was regarded perhaps by many as antisocial or confusing, and that, you know, that sparked occupations on the West Coast. And through this long, slow process over years, the foundation was built upon which Occupy Wall Street could take place. Now, similarly, people in this country are now trying to legitimize the wave of tactics that can get us out of the Occupy impasse. If we call these people monsters, if we take every step that we can to delegitimize them, we will paralyze ourselves and the movement for the future. Rather, we should be explaining, we should be taking advantage of the ways that we're situated, and Hedges is situated better than I am for this purpose, to explain to others why people engage in these actions, why they are deemed necessary, and to draw from them what is useful, what all of us can apply, whether or not we ever wear a black sweatshirt. This is the business that we have to be humbly setting about, because as Chris said, violence isn't glorious, you know, but I also want to emphasize everything that is called violence is not bad, in fact. A lot of it is things that, if we can do them, we will be able to break the deadlock of oppression that holds us where we are. Finally, I want to say, if you don't want those who participate in Black Blocs, if you don't want those who are part of this movement to be able to make this case, to be able to try out new tactics and be able to legitimize them, you will have to demonize us to succeed. You will have to do what you did in Cancer of Occupy. You will have to say things about us that just aren't true or representative. You will have to make us into monsters. And in fact, there's too many of us in this movement for this to happen without this dialogue. Whether you want it or not, it's going to happen. And I'm not even sure that you want to set about this demonization. But To conclude, I want to say, what you said a second ago, that what you say is useless to the police, I don't buy it, because I saw your line, word for word, quoted by police, not attributing it, of course, but using exactly the same framework: Black Bloc is outside, Black Bloc is not legitimate protesters, Black Bloc is chaos, bent hooligans, in newspaper coverage building up to the RNC, the NATO protests, and elsewhere. So I feel like the fact that you, as somebody who agrees with many of the people here about the situation, the fact that you handed this narrative to the police was actually extremely irresponsible and dangerous for lots of people.
Well, the reason I sued Obama over the NDAA is because I knew the first group they were going to go after was the Black Bloc. And then they'll work their way up the ladder. They pick off the marginal groups first. They've already done a pretty good job of decimating Muslim American activists, whether it's Fahad Hashmi or Sami Al Aryan or anyone else. And they use precisely the same tactics. In the case of Fahad Hashmi, and he was held here in New York in Guantanamo-like conditions, 23 hours a day in isolation, naked. They never turned off his light bulb in his cell. What they were using to prosecute him with were tapes of talks that he'd given as a student activist when he was at Brooklyn College. You look closely at the Muslim American community, and you can see where they're going and what they want to do. And the next group they'll go after, and you've already seen it in the case, was it in Cleveland, where they got these, used an agent provocateur to get these kids supposedly to blow up a bridge. And we saw it, as I mentioned earlier, in the NDAA case where they tried to demonize U.S. state outrage. They know what's coming. I agree with Brian that we are certainly headed for a period of deep instability and unrest, and the corporate state is working overtime to create the legal structure whereby any whisper of dissent becomes impossible. I'm not going to get into this Graeber argument as to whether what I write, you know, suddenly gives the Homeland Security an idea of, you know, what they want to say. Maybe they are. Maybe they read everything I write. I hope they read everything I write, but I kind of doubt it. You know, the question really comes down to what's going to work. And I have yet to hear a coherent explanation on the part of Black Bloc. Number one is the kind of vision that they have for the society that we want to create and how these tactics are going to get us there. If we do not bring the mainstream over to our side, I don't think we can win. And I think what we have not raised is that this backlash could very well be hijacked by proto-fascist movements. The Christian right, the Tea Party. And unlike us, they are going to be bankrolled by the most retrograde elements of American capitalism, the Koch brothers and others, just as the German industrialists bankroll the Nazi Party. Political paralysis creates extremes, and the longer that paralysis continues, the more people walk away from the systems of power. And when these corporate interests feel threatened, they have the capacity to empower these proto-fascist organizations that celebrate the gun culture, that speak in the language of violence, and that do what all fascist movements do, which is to demonize the vulnerable. Muslims, undocumented workers, homosexuals, intellectuals, liberals, feminists, they have a very long list of people they hate. And fascism and violence run like a very dark, we are a very, very violent society. And I think that in times of instability, we cannot rule out that this backlash may be a populist right-wing backlash. And that has to be part of our consciousness when we begin to raise the issue of effective resistance.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Chris. It seems to me that it isn't just bullets or tear gas canisters with which the government represses us. Above all, they use the narrative, they frame the narrative. Now, I'm sure that you believe this in the same way that I do, otherwise you wouldn't have written that the Black Bloc was giving the government the excuse to repress us. That's a matter of narrative. If we create this other narrative, as I understand it, which you were trying to do, you can see how that would also be useful to the government, right? And you mentioned the thing in Cleveland. I really appreciate you mentioning those kids who've basically been entrapped there, but it's significant that those kids were called in the mainstream media. They were described as Black Bloc anarchists, even though there's no evidence that any of them had participated in a Black Bloc. And that's because the narrative that came out of Cancer of Occupy and out of all of this invective was that whoever it is that is scary is the Black Bloc. Bomb makers are the Black Bloc. And this is very useful to the government because, well, what would it have taken for us to say in those occupations? Maybe feeling entitled to wear masks, maybe feeling entitled to resist, maybe feeling entitled not to be afraid of standing up for ourselves. And the narrative that they're going for, their operation, is to create an environment in which whenever average Americans, whoever that is, see people who are doing the things that it would take to maintain space, they will say, oh, those must be bombers, they must be terrorists, they must be like those people in Cleveland. Do y'all understand what I'm saying? This is absolutely what they're trying to do. So as for what our vision of change is, like I've said throughout, using the same examples that I think Hedges endorses, our task is to expand the range of what people feel entitled to do. Do this humbly, do this persistently, and not glorify anything, but just go about the business of trying to do this. We're going to be demonized, even by people that should be our allies, as we do this. We're going to face all sorts of name-calling and invective, but just to continue doing it courageously, unstoppably. Thanks.
I'd now like to invite both of our speakers to give a 4-minute closing statement, so if we can start with Chris.
Yeah, I mean, traditional anarchism I'm deeply sympathetic with. I come out of the Christian anarchist movement, Dorothy Day, where you have a constant alienation from power. I think the issue is power. It doesn't really matter who holds it. When Karl Popper writes the Open Society and Its Enemies, he says that the question of how we get good people to rule is the wrong question. Most people, he says, who are attracted to power are at best mediocre, which is Obama or venal, which is Romney or Bush. The question is, how do you get those in power to be frightened of you? And you do that by building movements. The anti-organizational element of the Black Bloc, which is not something, by the way, that the great anarchist thinkers of the late 19th century and the early 20th century embraced, whether that was Bakunin or Kropotkin, Emma Goldman, Berkman. They all believed in the primacy of astute and intelligent organization and effective tactics. All of the correctives to American democracy came through movements, popular movements, that never achieved formal positions of power. Whether that was the Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists who fought for women's rights, the labor movement, and finally the civil rights movement. And you could argue that until he was assassinated in April of 1968, the most powerful political figure in the United States was Martin Luther King. Because when he went to Memphis, 50,000 people went with him. And we have no hope left unless we rebuild those movements that were systematically destroyed. I spend a lot of time in Death of the Liberal Class talking about it, starting in World War I, in the name of anti-communism, and what Dwight MacDonald calls our psychosis of permanent war. And when the Soviet Union went down, the most vile elements of the power elite needed something to take its place, and it became terrorism. War, as Randolph Bourne writes, is the health of a state, the ability to accrue themselves all sorts of power. And we are reaching a crisis moment as we decline, both as an empire, and we watch the collapse of globalization and the rise of frightening reconfiguration of the ecosystem for which we depend for existence. And if we don't rebuild those popular movements, we will have nothing left by which we will protect both ourselves and finally the next generation from the devastation that's being visited upon us by our corporate overlords. The great novel I've come to believe of the American experience is Moby Dick. These figures are all Ahabs. When 40% of the Arctic sea ice melts, all they talk about is exploiting the last vestiges of oil, mineral, gas, and fish stocks. It is collective suicide. As Ahab says in the book, my methods and my means are sane, my object is mad. And we have very, very little time left. And so the tactics we employ have to be smart, because The forces arrayed against us are working overtime to crush us.
Thank you, Chris. Brian, please.
Right. I have no fantastic, inspiring closing statement. I didn't prepare one. I don't usually, like I said, try to come on stages like this. I felt that this was necessary in this particular situation because somebody who has a lot of leverage and legitimacy was using it irresponsibly. And it's hard for me to imagine that Kropotkin, Berkman, Goldman, and Bakunin would be sitting in the crowd here applauding as Hedges continues to hedge, I guess, and refuse to acknowledge and apologize the risk that he has put people at by spreading this narrative. I want to say also the idea that the Black Bloc is anti-organization, that the Black Bloc is something monolithic. I want to say there are many different forms of organization that people who have participated in Black Blocs adhere to. This is not a matter of anti-organization. This is perhaps a matter of competing ideas about what kind of organization is going to be most effective. This is not a refusal of strategy. These are different strategies. We want a decentralized horizontal movement, a movement that doesn't have to subscribe all to one tactic in order to be able to move forward, a movement that is diverse and can make the most of that diversity. We won't and we cannot impose one format on struggle. That involves too much surgery, too much removing cancers one after the other until you find that all your organs are gone, you know? Like I said, we have to make the most of our diversity. And as I understand it, Hedges has revised his earlier position in the things he said and said that the Black Bloc is part of the movement and that people just have to understand that there is a proper time and place for everything. Oh, okay. I also want to be part of a movement with people who are not always wearing black sweatshirts. I agree about this. But please, next time you hear somebody from a position of tremendous power and influence saying, those poor people, those nobodies over there, they just want to destroy your movement, they're not part of it, think twice. You know, go talk to the nobodies. See what they have to say about this. And finally, if any of the things that I have said make sense to you tonight, let's continue talking with each other, let's continue meeting and building up a powerful movement so that we can actually get out of the situation. Thank you so much, everyone.
Okay. We're now going to move on to the question and answer portion. I have a lot of questions here, and I'm hoping we can get through as many as possible. So if I can ask the speakers to try and limit the responses to about 1 minute, if possible. First question is for Chris. Can you explain what you meant when you called the Black Panther Party parasites? Do you still feel this is an accurate assessment and the American Indian movement?
I don't remember ever calling them parasites. Do you have an article where I called the Black Panther parasites? I don't remember.
It's okay, everybody. I'll cite the article that he's talking about. I read it, right? It's the one where you say violent parasites or violent extremists attach themselves to all social movements like parasites, the Black Panther Party, the American Indian Movement, and then you run through and you're the Symbionese Liberation Army by the end. As I understood it, that's what you were doing. I didn't write the question, but that was my impression.
Right.
Having read a fair bit of your material.
I mean, the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement are different movements from, let's say, the Weather Underground. The Weather Underground is sort of white, privileged, and nihilistic. The Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement arise out of significant repression and violence that have been committed against those communities. And yet, I would argue that in the case of both AIM and the Black Panther, it gave to the state a kind of mechanism by which they could discredit the broader anti-war and civil rights movements. And that was, of course, always the tension between Martin Luther King and the Black Power movement. King, at the end, by 1968, became a very lonely figure, booed in Watts, and there were huge defections from Stokely Carmichael and others, even within his own movement. But I think that is my fear of violence, that resorting to acts of violence cripple and hurt mass movements, and give to the security state the kind of publicity, and no question that the security state blows whatever activities are done by these groups way out of proportion, but gives them a kind of publicity vehicle that they loop. I mean, go back and look at the 1968 revolution in France, which was carried out mostly by labor, 11 million people carrying out sit-down strikes, and de Gaulle used a kind of fringe movement that was violent and then looped it constantly on television to justify the excesses of the state itself.
Thank you. The next question is for Brian. Would you say violence is entirely a sociolinguistic construct, or would you accept the more common usage of the term as reflecting a material event that causes harm to or violates the integrity of the human body? Why or why not? Thanks, Tracy.
Well, violence is a mix of all these different things, right? It's a discursive, it's a matter of discourse, something like this, right? It means different things to different people, which is one of the reasons that I think it's really important that we don't say we're nonviolent and assume that that means the same thing to everyone. That if, especially if you want to identify as being nonviolent, if you think that's important, you have to be able to clarify exactly what that is and also protect people who don't use that language from the kind of delegitimization that the legitimization of nonviolence equips others to carry out against them. Does that make sense? You all follow me? Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The next question is for Chris. Can there be a coexistence of black bloc and nonviolent tactics? If yes, in what form and what situation?
I think there has to be a respect for diversity of tactics. And the black bloc has to respect the tactics of nonviolent movements. I don't support the vision of the black bloc or their tactics. And yet at the same time, I'm certainly not going to do anything to impede, you know, having them carry out those tactics. And that's what I'm asking for, that they respect those divisions. And if they respect those divisions and they call a black bloc action, you know, I won't attend, but I'm certainly not going to help the authorities do anything to crush them.
The next question is for either Chris or Brian. Do you think occupying, in quotation marks, is a form of liberal protest or a way of expropriating the means of existence from the privileged classes? Is it possible to do the latter without incurring the violence of the state?
The answer to that is no, of course, because the violence of the state was visited upon Occupy. Mass movements have a kind of power because they resonate with the mainstream. And this movement, what was the Occupy movement, what we're seeing in Chicago, is different from the civil rights movement. King needed white liberals, which proved very fickle allies, in the battle for racial justice. But as soon as racial equality was advanced and King attempted to advance economic justice, the white liberals deserted him. And in many ways, the civil rights movement was a legal victory, but an economic failure. And King understood that without economic justice, there would finally never be racial justice, which is why the bottom two-thirds of African Americans in this country are worse off than they were in the 60s when King was leading civil rights marches in the South. And the issue of economic justice is one that I think Occupy picked up. And they picked it up because there were large numbers of white, middle-class, college-educated kids who suddenly began to experience what people in marginal communities and people of color have been experiencing for several decades. Police repression is hardly anything new if you live in East New York. But it was new if you were a graduate of Oberlin College and working in a deli. And my assaults against the liberal class are precisely that they retreated into a kind of boutique activism of multiculturalism, identity politics, inclusiveness, and forgot the primacy of justice for the working class and the poor. And if we are to succeed as a movement. We've got to recapture that the economic primacy of justice in order to go forward.
I'll just say something really quick about this. Is occupying a form of liberal protest or a way of expropriating the means of existence? That's the question I was trying to pose, however clumsily, at the beginning. If we see what we're doing as an appeal, as a registering of dissent, it will not change the situation that we're in. If we approach it as a project of actually getting our hands on the resources that we need to remedy the imbalances in our society, yes, we're more likely to come into conflict with the state. And it's telling that when we set out to expropriate the means of existence from the privileged classes, we barely feel entitled even to take over a public park. You know, this emphasizes again how important this project of becoming more confident in ourselves, of trusting ourselves more, of feeling more entitled to act, you know, not feeling like a public park is barely the most we are entitled to, but all of the riches that we have produced in this world. Thanks.
The next question is for Chris. What is different about the United States? You have embraced the Egyptian uprising, where crowds physically fought police for access to and control over Tahrir Square, but renounced even verbal violence towards police in advising the Occupy movement. How can this be explained morally and practically?
Well, first of all, you're pulling 500,000 people into Tahrir Square. That's number one. And number two, the most crucial moment in the Egyptian uprising was when the army commanders realized that they could not call upon their soldiers to fire upon the crowd. And if you remember, there were pictures of occupiers in Tahrir Square climbing up on the tanks of the soldiers. What I think goes right back to proving my point. For me, the most effective strategy is not to confront the pillars of power, but to draw them towards us by fragmenting them. And that's why even verbal abuse to the police is a mistake. The police are working class. They come from working class communities. They work at these financial centers earning $37 an hour as rent-a-cops. They watch these guys walk by in their $8,000 suits, and they might as well be a piece of the furniture. And the effectiveness of the movement will come with creating internal divisions within these structures of power, whether it's civil service, whether it's security forces, or anything else. And that creates internal systems of paralysis. I'm not promising that it will work. I certainly am not in any way defending, in many cases, what the police do. I'm just talking about a tactic that I have seen work in Eastern Europe, and that is potentially effective and I think worth pursuing.
Okay. The next question is for Brian. Has the Black Bloc ever been engaged in a protest that was successful? Did the Iraq War continue nonetheless? Did NAFTA pass? Did OWS have any victories, if it can call its own in general?
Well, I'm not sure how the person who framed that question defines success. My argument would be that success is a very complicated thing. You can't immediately gauge it. If we frame success as preventing the government from doing something, that's difficult. We rarely succeed with any tactics from getting them not to pass a particular kind of legislation, but the Black Bloc is not a kind of hard lobbying. The Black Bloc is a way for people to act together anonymously, to make the most use, as they see fit, of their own personal capabilities. And in that regard, every time people engage anonymously, collectively, in an activity that they wish to, that they otherwise could not, it is a success. It's a success for the participants in that it returns a little bit of autonomy and a little bit of power to those who engage in this. Now, of course, we have to look at these things strategically as well, as Hedges is arguing. You could argue in theory that the Black Bloc that happened in Seattle in 1999 that was so famous was strategic and successful in that it galvanized young people all around the country to perk up and to become really excited about what was going on in the anti-globalization movement. I'll admit I was a punk rocker in the 1990s, and in 1998 it wasn't very easy to find another punk rocker who could tell you much about the World Trade Organization. By 2000, just about every punk rocker that I met could give you a long rundown on the IMF and World Bank and how they were implicated in oppressive policies throughout the global south. And this is because when you don't know what to do, when you can't imagine yourself taking any action, it's hard to become invested in the issue. It's hard to become invested in anything. You know, this is why strategies that begin from education often have limits. But when you feel there is something you can do, however small, often you come to be really really focused on the issues and to learn about your agency and what you are capable of doing. In that regard, that Black Bloc and many others, I would say, have been extremely successful in catalyzing the movements that we see around the United States now, or else we wouldn't be having this conversation in the first place.
The next question is for Chris. Who precisely are the mainstream that you seem so keen to let define the parameters of political action?
If you are going to draw the mainstream into your movement, which I think was the power of Occupy, then you've got to work within those limits. I have, like probably many people in this room, serious issues with the very concept of a wage economy. And yet I think people have to be brought into movement step by step. There was tremendous sympathy throughout the country for the Occupy encampments, and in particular Occupy Wall Street, and you saw it, especially after the police that first week carried out the pepper spraying of the three women who were kettled behind the netting. There was a kind of revulsion at what was happening. Occupy created a discourse that had been absent within the mainstream, and the mainstream responded. And they saw that the Occupy movement articulated what they were undergoing and what they were enduring and the kinds of questions that were not being addressed and asked by our class of pundits and our political leaders. And I think, again, going back to something I've said repeatedly throughout this discourse, the power that we have is going to be in our ability to bring the kinds of numbers into the streets that were brought into Tahrir Square, that were brought into Alexanderplatz in East Berlin with the fall of the communist government, that were brought into Wenceslas Square in the Velvet Revolution, which I also covered. If we can't bring those numbers in, then I don't think we have much chance of succeeding as a movement.
The next question is from Wayne Price, for Brian. Chris says that the Black Bloc makes it difficult to make a mainstream movement. Brian, how would you build a popular big movement? And then for Chris, is the mainstream all that counts? What about militancy?
I guess in terms of how to build a popular big movement, this is a challenging question today, and a question that we could get into really deep. You know, it used to be that you could just build a workers' movement. Nowadays, we pass from job to job so fast that it's really hard to hold on to any kind of situation from which we can organize with others like us. It's not surprising that the major anti-capitalist or potentially anti-capitalist movement that took off in the last couple of years was situated outside the workplace in public squares where the disenfranchised are, you know, or where people who have enough time between their 10 different Craigslist jobs can show up to participate. Building a movement when we are atomized like this by capitalism is a real challenge. The main thing that I would say is that it's a process of building bridges and connections between people in different situations. people who are marginalized in different ways. And that's why, in addition to participating in militant forms of struggle, I think it's very important to always set about the process of explaining ourselves and connecting with others. To try to say why it is that I, as a marginally employed, late 30s anarchist, am involved in the things that I am. And this is the closest I can give you, Mr. Price, I fear, is make the effort to connect with other people who are vulnerable or targeted in the same or different ways by capitalism, figure out what we can do together, and move forward.
The state did not look at the Occupy endeavor as a mainstream movement. They looked at it as a militant movement. Of course, those of us, and not only was it militant, let's be clear, it was revolutionary. Because it did, as Crane Brinton writes in his study of revolutions, Anatomy of a Revolution, it did finally what all revolutions do. It demanded of the state terms that the state can never fulfill because it would mean its own dissolution. It asked, remember they kept saying on a sort of, what are your demands, what are your demands, what are your demands? Well, the demand was really clear. We want to reverse the corporate coup d'etat that we've undergone. But that's not a demand that the power elite can hear, because what we're asking is that they go out of existence. And that's why I think what we have unleashed is a movement. And remember, revolutionary movements take a long time to build. The Stamp Act or the Stamp Rebellion in 1765 was the precursor to the revolution in 1776. The uprisings in Russia in 1905 was the precursor to 1917. That's what we've begun. But it will change. It will mutate. It needs to be deeply self-critical and smart. If you look at the history of the civil rights movement, like any movement, it's never a straight line. There were terrible failures in Albany, Mississippi, and other places, reverses, but it was the capacity within the civil rights movement or within Solidarity. Go back and look at the 10 years of Solidarity before it achieved power. To understand what worked, what didn't work, what was a dead end, and what wasn't. And I think that we live in a period where by the language that we use to describe both our reality and our political system no longer work. And in some ways, one of the first things we're doing is begin to look for a new language by which to describe what's happening to us.
The next question is for Brian. What use is Black Bloc tactics when violence is used against occupiers? And they've given the reference of the live stream of Oakland protests when occupiers are protesting peacefully, when Black Blocs showed up, occupiers tried to protest police in a protect people in a store, and Black Bloc protesters attacked occupiers.
Black Bloc protesters. Okay, well, I wasn't there, so I can't speak to this in particular. It's worth saying that I am not saying that every time someone breaks a window or attacks someone else that it is a good thing. Just to clarify, the heart of my point is that the criteria according to which we critique militant action have to be more precise than these people are outsiders, these people are monsters. Sure, there are plenty of cases in which people do things that are unstrategic or even downright bad, but it just obscures the question, makes it more difficult to discuss this if every time a criticism of a specific event is advanced, it's part of a general delegitimizing of the target of that criticism. That's the best I can do, not having noticed this event, not having been there.
The next question is for Chris. Do you support turning in Black Bloc members to the police? What levels of violence are you willing to use against those who do not fit your definition of peaceful?
No, I'm not going to turn people into the police. And what was the second question? Look, I'm opposed to violence. I really don't buy this argument about, you know, who gets to define violence. I'll tell you who gets to define violence. The victims get to define violence. My closest friend in high school was gay, and he was an evangelical. And his father berated him as a faggot, and the church told him he was filled with Satan and unclean, and he committed suicide. As far as I know, he was never physically touched. And yet I think his father and his church committed an act of murder. Violence comes in many, many forms. It's not physical. It can be verbal. There are many ways to destroy human beings. We have armies of psychologists in Guantanamo who know, without touching you, how to reduce you to a fetal position and a quivering mass. And so this sort of gradations of violence, what is violence? Violence, it's those who suffer from violence, those who are victims of violence. They are the only people, in my mind, who have a legitimate right to tell us what violence is.
The next question sounds like a really big one that I'm not sure if you can each answer in 1 minute, but I'll put it out there and see what you want to do. Can you both please explain your theory of change? What do you each see as the best strategy to build power and win material gains for the 99%? In 1 minute.
Do you want to go first, Chris?
Well, whatever we do, change is coming. It's coming with the implosion of our imperium, and it's coming with the rapid degradation of the ecosystem itself. And there's nothing we can do to stop it. It's how will we cope with this change? Will we respond rationally? Will we learn to speak to the world with a new humility and recreate structures within our own communities for sustainability? Or will we continue to live in illusion? The response to the climate crisis is a perfect example. We have huge half of the country that denies that climate change exists and the other half arguing that we can adapt. Both are forms of magical thinking. The fact is we can no longer afford not only the levels of consumption, but the empire itself. And it's all folding in on itself. And the physical signs are around us. The collapsing infrastructure, the chronic and long-term unemployment, the fact that 46 million Americans live in poverty and tens of millions live in a category called near poverty, the closure of libraries, of schools, of firehouses, it's all there. And in a way, it's a matter of awakening ourselves to our new reality and responding to it. And if we do not, if we continue to live in a state of illusion, then as that edifice collapses, we will respond like people who have been betrayed but do not understand the centers of betrayal or the reasons of betrayal. And when I spoke about proto-fascist movements, I think become susceptible to movements which will embrace violence, but will at their core be not only anti-democratic, but target all of the vulnerable forces within the society, whether it's African Americans or gays or those of us who embrace a kind of equality and inclusiveness.
Thank you. So, I'll have Brian sort of answer as his closing statement.
Yeah, I am looking forward to years of organizing and acting, probably with many of y'all. My theory of change is just keep at it, basically, right? The thing that I want, if you take one thing away from tonight, the argument that I'm making is that when we evaluate tactics, strategies, actions, the question we should ask is, do they create a more horizontal distribution of power or not? Right? Do they equip us for self-determination or not? I don't know if we can save the world. I don't know what's possible. We can't know what the future holds, but we can invest ourselves in acting according to our consciences now, no matter what people call us when we do, in such a way that others will feel entitled to do the same. All right, thank you. Thank you very much.
I'd like to just add my own closing statement as a moderator. I have to admit that I was one of the people at Occupy with the strollers that Chris talked about. I have two really young children, and I was really disappointed that finally revolution was coming and I have to be at home with my kids. But I think one of the really inspiring things to me about it was the number of people who came out offering childcare so that I could go to meetings and be part of it. And the second thing that was exciting was the number of local movements that came up, and I was a part of the Harlem, West Harlem 99% group. That was one of the very inspiring things about what Occupy did, I felt, was it took the debate out of where it usually happens and took it out to the communities and took it out to the boroughs and took it out all over the place. And that's kind of what I'd like to see happen with this debate, too. I'd really like it to see broaden to issues about, you know, police brutality against communities of color, to take up issues and be very relevant within, you know, a broad range of communities. And this has been a really, I mean, I think this is an important and a very interesting debate. And I would like to thank both of our speakers for being very eloquent and for making my job as a moderator very, very easy by keeping to their time limits very well. And thank you very much to the audience for being here as well.
Now, while of course I hope this show's been helpful on a practical level, and the discussion we've had has helped clarify your thinking on what you'll be prepared to do, what you're not prepared to do, and why, then I thought, let's end with some more philosophical thoughts. I went to YouTube and looked up Wall Street, and without even typing his name, was pleased to find the following video, which has seen hundreds of thousands of people seeing it. This is speaker very familiar to regular listeners, Charles Eisenstein. This is what he had to say about the 99% and the Occupy movement.
This movement isn't about the 99% defeating or toppling the 1%. You know, the next chapter of that story, which is that the 99% create a new 1%. That's not what it's about. What we want to create is the more beautiful world our hearts tell us is possible, a sacred world, a world that works for everybody, a world that is healing, a world of peace. You can't just say, we demand a world of peace. Demands have to be specific. Anything that people can articulate can only be articulated within the language of the current political discourse. And that entire political discourse is already too small. And that's why making explicit demands kind of reduces the movement and takes the heart out of it. And so it's a real paradox. And so I think that the movement actually understands that. The system isn't working for the 1% either. You know, if you were a CEO, you would be making the same choices they do. The institutions have their own logic. Life is pretty bleak at the top, too. And all of the baubles of the rich, they're kind of this phony compensation for the loss of what's really important, the loss of community, the loss of connection, the loss of intimacy, the loss of meaning. Everybody wants to live a life of meaning. And today, we live in a money economy where we don't really depend on the gifts of anybody, but we buy everything. Therefore, we don't really need anybody, because whoever grew my food or made my clothes or built my house, well, if they died or if I alienate them, if they don't like me, that's okay. I can just pay somebody else to do it. And it's really hard to create community if the underlying knowledge is we don't need each other. So people kind of get together and they act nice, or maybe they consume together. But joint consumption doesn't create intimacy. Only joint creativity and gifts create intimacy and connection. You have such gifts that are important. Just like every species has an important gift to give to an ecosystem, and the extinction of any species hurts everybody, the same is true of each person, that you have a necessary and important gift to give. And that for a long time, our minds have told us that maybe we're imagining things, that it's crazy to live according to what you want to give. But I think now, as more and more people wake up to the truth that we're here to give, and wake up to that desire, and wake up to the fact that the other way isn't working anyway, the more reinforcement we have from people around us that this isn't crazy. This makes sense. This is how to live. And as we get that reinforcement, then our minds and our logic no longer have to fight against the logic of the heart, which wants us to be of service. This shift of consciousness that inspires such things is universal in everybody, 99% and 1%. And it's awakening in different people in different ways. I think love is the felt experience of connection to another being. An economist says that essentially more for you is less for me. But the lover knows that more for you is more for me too. If you love somebody, then their happiness is your happiness. Their pain is your pain. Your sense of self expands to include other beings. That's love. Love is the expansion of the self to include the other. And that's a different kind of revolution. There's no one to fight. There's no evil to fight. There's no other in this revolution. Everybody has a unique calling. And it's really time to listen to that. That's what the future is going to be. It's time to get ready for it and to help contribute to it and make it happen. Robbing the rich is poor, so for best they take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest.
This show and all previous episodes are available for download from our website at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a comments page if you'd like to discuss topics we raised, and if you'd like to find other programs about the Occupy movement, then just click on the word Occupy at the bottom of the page and you'll find a list of them. Similarly, if the thoughts of Charles Eisenstein are new to you, then you can click on Charles Eisenstein in the speakers list, and we have a lot of shows featuring his thoughts. If you'd like to help with production, you can email me a suggestion, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net, or you could contribute to the mailing list if you'd like to have some general discussion about it. And if you're a radio producer and you air the show, I'd encourage you to join that discussion list. It's fairly low traffic. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I've had a busy summer, and I've just moved back to Bangladesh, so if I haven't replied to your email, that's why. But I do appreciate all the emails you send me, and intend to reply to them.